don't have any visitors yet. We're trying our level best to have you accommodated. We do apologize. It says a lot for Sugar Mix. Yes. No, it says a lot for you because normally there's lots of places in this particular venue. And one of my colleagues wanted to know, why is there so many people? And I said, well, it's Sugar Mista. Yes, it's an umbrella body representing a whole wide range of organizations. So they're all represented here, I assume. Yes, I assume. Okay, sure. But welcome to all of you. This is our first day back from a short recess over the Easter period. You all have the programs which were emailed to you, and so this morning we're going to receive a briefing from the organization called Sugar Mesa. And without further ado, let me hand over to Sam and Lisa. Sam Waterhouse and Lisa Betten, for them to take us through and to introduce whoever needs introductions.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members, and thank you also to all the members of the committee and visitors. This presentation is going to be done by shared between Sam Waterhouse and myself on behalf of the Sugar Mesa campaign, which consists of about 29 different organizations in 5 different provinces in the country. So we have put a list. Yes, we're not sure why they fell off the page, but there are actually 29 different organizations which you'll see listed on the submission, coming from Free State, Limpopo, Northwest, and Mpumalanga, as well as Gauteng, Free State, Western Cape as well. So even if, I would like to think, even if you may think you have only one submission, it's actually a whole lot of organizations. I think to begin with, we would really like to say we appreciate the call for comment and the opportunity to be able to address the committee and to share our insights and comments on the budget and strategic plan. I think we do note at the outset that obviously the Department of Justice faces a range of different priorities that they must meet, not just those of sexual offences. So we do acknowledge that they have to balance a host of different priorities. But I think what is important to us is that certainly at the level of the rhetorical, the department has often said that sexual offences is a priority crime. They do have a directorate, vulnerable groups, that is addressed to sexual offences, domestic violence and child justice. So I think our interest in the budget is to what extent does the rhetorical commitment translate into a financial commitment. So that's what we are really looking at. I mean, if we treat the budget as an expression of policy, we clearly need to see if what is said in policy is being matched in terms of implementation and the budget that is allocated. And we're going to be looking predominantly, we're going to look at both the Department of Justice and the NPA, not just the department's budget. And we will be looking only at sexual offences, obviously acknowledging that there are other important issues as well. I mean, I think our concern is that clearly it's not exclusively and solely the Department of Justice's responsibility to reduce sexual offences. They can't really do that. But we do note there is a broader context in which sexual offences remain very high. And I think we can ask some questions about the extent to which the criminal justice system is a deterrent, even if it's not pure primary prevention. We do note that there have been, over the last 20 years, a number of key developments in both legislation and policy to address sexual offences, but we are concerned about the stagnation and regression. Don't think that, with the exception of the Sexual Offences Act in 2007, there wouldn't appear to have been much in the way of policy developed since 2000, and in fact, we've even seen some policy reversals relating, of course, to the sexual offences. So the question we do have to ask, is the state response to sexual offences making a difference? And I think with the recent furore over Aneen Boyson's murder and rape, and unfortunately it's only one out of an unending constant stream, has once again highlighted this question of what is the response, not only the Department of Justice, but society as a whole to the scourge. I think now that's why we want to be looking at, to what extent has the rhetoric that has emerged following the recent rape murder translated into policy and budget. So I think to put this into a context, I think clearly conviction rates are not the only way in which one measures the performance of the criminal justice system, but they are very important. So we want to have a look contextually at what we're seeing more broadly in terms of conviction rates. Now, some of the data we have pre-2007, I think, gives us a very good baseline against which we can assess whether or not the Sexual Offences Act had ultimately made any difference to the manner in which sexual offences are dealt with. So data from Gauteng for 2003 put the conviction rate in that province for 4%. Mpumalanga, this data relates to one rural police station. We note that that's obviously not representative, but I think we do want to highlight the particular unique difficulties that are being faced in rural areas and possibly the very poor quality of justice that is being received. And I think also just to note that Mpumalanga, from data from early 2000s from the IDMT, was the province with the lowest conviction rate in the country. So I think that is telling us that we need to look at what's happening in each province, not just the national picture. But anyway, between 2005 and 2007, of the 120 adult women who reported, one, or 0.8% of those 120 cases resulted in a conviction. And of the children, the 98 who reported, 4% resulted in a conviction. So I put that in because I do think we need to consider what is happening in rural provinces. This is data from the National Prosecuting Authority, and it's for all sexual offences. And we do just want to...
1 minute. Sorry, just because this is not in the... You haven't given us the slides, and
okay.
Those stats are not in the document.
They are.
I couldn't find them.
No, they are. Okay, Jinder.
All right, it was just to ask them, where is the, what's the basis of the information, NPA statistics?
The first two, the Carl thing is a study, which is footnoted, and one called Trapped Injustice.
Yeah.
The second one is called A Criminal Injustice System. They are both footnoted. Should the committee want, we can send both links during the course of this presentation to the chair for you to have a look at this. Okay. The NPA data is national data and it's for all sexual offences, which of course refer to all 59 crimes. I do just want to say that the Gauteng data did suggest that conviction rates for rape are somewhat lower than those for other sexual offences. So it may well be that the percentage here is somewhat higher than it would be if we were looking at rape only. So for 2007-2008, there's a 4.5% national conviction rate listed. In 2008-09, 5%, and then in 2011-12 was good enough to be 7%. Again, referring to all sexual offences. I think just looking through the departmental data, it's very hard to get a picture across all the different departments who are part of the criminal justice system, because I don't think you can measure them separately from one another since they all interact. But those statistics are quite opaque and they're quite hard to obtain, and sometimes they can only be obtained through access to information applications. So I do think, as a recommendation to the committee, that is something the department should be reporting on routinely. We're getting data just from the police on the number of rapes reported, but that is in some ways a very incomplete measure of justice as a whole. So that could be something that the NPA Justice looks at, is integrating their statistics from the moment the case comes into its reporting to when it drops out and when somebody goes into prison, so that would include correctional services. And we do also just note, as the departments themselves note, that they use different definitions for what they're measuring. There was the project, and we hope we got the name right, since you haven't heard of it for a while, but that was the Justice Footprint, the attempt to track offences across all the departments. So we just wondered where that was in terms of trying to put those statistics together into a comprehensive picture. And as a recommendation, there was a need to make the statistics publicly available. So we don't just have the figures at entry point for the police, but right through the criminal justice system. Obviously, we don't expect every single case to result in a trial, nor every single case to result in a conviction, but it is important to be able to start tracking that information.
Also, sorry, just as part of the introduction, I wanted to note that our written submission goes into a lot of detail in the last, I think, 12-odd pages relating to the content of policy, which we're actually not going to speak to in as much detail. So we are focusing particularly on the strat plans and budgets, but we would very much like an opportunity to engage the committee as well as the department on that detail at some point. But just looking at the budgets and the plans, Lisa's mentioned that we have this rhetoric of priority, political statements very clearly being made that dealing with sexual offences is a priority. And so we were hoping to be able to track this particular priority in some of the detail in order to assess what the plans are going forward. As Lisa's also said, now I want to reiterate it at this point because from what I'm about to say, it's going to sound very much like I'm saying we just want sexual offences to be addressed. We're speaking to sexual offences because that's our interest, but again, do completely understand there are other priorities for the department. I'm waiting for the critique. So the first point we want to make is that throughout the plans, there's certain details in the strategies, both of the NPA and the department more broadly, which are quite detailed. It may, and I'll speak to them. It may relate to infrastructure. It may relate to prosecution generally. And there's an argument to be made, at the very least, for attention to be drawn to the fact that sexual offences are different from many other offences. They're not the only priorities, and they're not necessarily the only terrible crimes in the system. But there's a significant proportion of sexual offence matters in the system, and those victims are living in our society, generally for years on end, waiting for some kind of outcome, generally being exposed on a repeated basis, often over 6 months or so, going back to the court and being exposed to the emotional trauma that is associated with the memory of the event, and then engaging with people in an adversarial way about the event. So there's this trauma that's happening, and we speak to that notion of the freedom from all forms of violence, and including psychological harm. And on the basis of that, are arguing that, and you'll see in the exact instances where I suggested, that there are points where we might want to say that sexual offences need to be prioritised above other offences, particularly the less serious crimes or where there's less or lower levels of trauma associated with those other forms of victimisation. So we note the gaps. We can't see sexual offences in this plan. We note that sexual offences courts, Tutuzela Care Centres and the National Register for Sex Offenders are mentioned in relation to the Department of Justice's Objective 9 on vulnerable groups, specific mention of sexual offences. We don't see any other detail about the plan. We see some numbers. We see how many Tutuzela Care Centres or how many sexual offence courts are planned, but we don't see money. We don't see salaries. We don't see infrastructure costs anywhere throughout. What we don't see in the department's strategy, we don't see on the reduction of the case backlog role, we don't see sexual offences mentioned or any of the priorities. We don't see the priorities, and again, of sexual offences in the best interest of children. So we're seeing Department of Justice, we're seeing child justice related aspects there, and we're seeing child protection related, family court issues, sorry. Lots of maintenance, which we love, but we're not commenting on maintenance. I wished there was someone who was responding to all the maintenance that's dealt with, but it's not us. We're not seeing sexual offences being dealt with in the objective to increase justice to historically marginalised communities. So bringing in some of the issues of the intersections of sexual offences prosecution in relation to areas where there is really bad quality of justice systems. And then likewise, generally improving delivery of services at court. So it's only mentioned as these very discrete issues in one objective, TCCs, SOCs, and the register. As a result, we don't see the disaggregation of budgets. So for example, as I mentioned, we talk about the sexual offences courts being reintroduced. And you'll notice in our submission we're calling, in fact, not only for the courts, but improved prosecution of sexual offences, and Lisa will talk to that a little bit later. We should be able to see what the spending is going to be on this introduction of courts somewhere. If this information is available within the department, then it should be made available to the committee. The NPA, again, it's unclear how much of the spending on sexual offences and the reintroduction of the courts is coming out of specialised prosecutions and how much comes out of national prosecutions. I assume, and I think when I was drafting this particular line, I used so many words to try and describe, I have no knowledge, assume, so surmise, suppose. I don't know what is going on because I can't see it in the budget, and that's really the point, is that we can't see. But we do imagine that spending on prosecutions for sexual offences is coming out of the national prosecution's budget, and as such would like to see how sexual offences are dealt with, and any other priority for that matter. Our question in relation to this would be, we would want to be able to assess, is the proportion of sexual offence matters entering the court system reflected in the proportion of the budget being spent on salaries and other infrastructural aspects. Then in respect of the Department of Justice, this has fallen off the page, but we note that in the directorate of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, we're informed that there are only two people employed in the department working on sexual offences within the directorate that works on vulnerable groups. I mean, I'm not sure how that then speaks to the level of priority afforded to us by the department. In terms of the detail, I'm not sure. Sorry, we were moving things around. I'll start with the case backlogs. We note the NPA have the clearing of case, or the clearing of case backlogs is a, not just NPA, is a priority. How are sexual offences dealt with? So in my first slide, when I was saying that these matters, for particular reasons, should be given particular attention, and that reason is the particular or the extra harm that's caused to these victims. So in reducing case backlogs, I'm very curious to know how that plan speaks to sexual offences. Are we targeting the quicker cases to win, the quicker cases to finalise, or are sexual offences from the department side seen as something that are prioritised because of the impact on victims? A big issue clearly for this committee is going to be the issue of compensation to employees in terms of the NPA budget and their frank assessment that they're not going to be able to really deal with this matter without more budget. Again, the question is, how is the spending on prosecutors in the specialised courts or on generally in terms of prosecuting sexual offences, how is that prioritised? The NPA talks about a human resources strategy. I haven't seen the strategy. It says they're busy with it. It is implied that it's not final. Perhaps it is, but the document implies that it's not final. Again, how are sexual offences dealt with? Who's paying for court preparation officers? Is it coming out of the justice budget? Is it coming through the NPA budget? In which line item are court preparation officers dealt with? So there's a tremendous amount of detail of issues that are critical to prosecuting sexual offence as well that we cannot see, and particularly here in relation to the human resources allocations. In terms of infrastructure, there are plans, there are courts being built all over the country. Again, particular aspects of building courts that relate to sexual offences. So spatial requirements, not just, we know that CCTVs are on the agenda, people understand the need for it. However, are the spaces required dealt with? And I'll jump to a slide on that. So we have presented this to this committee in the past, the findings of the Shukumisa research. There's a report, it's a black and orange document in front of you. Not the first time you're seeing it. But in that research, noting that 28 courts are monitored by monitors from the campaign membership, and through that we found a number of things. We found a high instance or incidence. I mean, most courts have CCTV systems. However, not all are working. We haven't assessed how many are not working. But what you're seeing in terms of space is that there aren't many courts or most have witness waiting rooms, but you don't have rooms for court preparation or for the psychosocial support services that are offered by NGOs on site. What's not then being taken into account, again, is the psychological impact that is experienced by many victims as they walk through waiting rooms where the accused and their supporters are sitting, as they are interacting prior to the actual trial and prior to giving their evidence with the accused. That result, as I mentioned, firstly has an impact on the trauma and the psychological well-being, but it also has an impact on the quality of evidence that people place before the court. And that is being missed in the budgets. We're not seeing if all the new courts are dealing with this question of space that is required. And obviously we don't even know how CCTV is being dealt with, but assume that that is the case. The last thing I want to note at this point is, it's on the previous slide, but you can't see it. So, you can see it. Okay, we can't see it up top. It's the issue of the National Register. You've heard this before. Again, two registers, spending on two registers makes no sense. We have money to, we have other places in which we need to spend the money. So we call once again for amendment to the Act to consolidate the Register in the Children's Act and the Sexual Offences Act.
One of the things we note the department is highlighting specifically are the Tutuzela care centres, which I think are important. They are a good model. There are approximately 52, but only 51 in operation, we understand. And if you look at the data provided by the NPA, they seem to be seeing about half of all sexual offences reported. So I think that's just a question we raise, that it's important to have a good model, but what about the other half? What is the alternative? The Tutuzela care centre model is very resource intensive, so it's difficult to justify in a small rural area where you might only be seeing 14 or 15 rapes in a month. So we do raise the question of what about those other cases? What is the standard and quality of service that they receive? So the first of the Tutuzela, just for a brief background, was established in 2000. There is a blueprint, but this doesn't appear to have ever been consolidated into a comprehensive policy which is available in the public domain. So I think one of the consequences of that is just talking to people who work within the TCCs is that there's a bit of a difference in practice. So some Tutuzela care centres, as you will note, appear to have psychosocial services available from NGOs, but all do not. And from what we can also see is that those NGOs who are working within those Tutuzela care centres are being paid in very different ways. And they're offering different kinds of services. Some are available on a 24/7 basis, but some are not. So I think the first question needs to be, there must be a policy, a comprehensive policy, because I think once you have that policy, then one can ascertain, is the budget for that policy adequate? But where there is no detail, there can be no true assessment. I mean, I want to note, we stand to be corrected, but it's just really hard to find this information, is that we asked the NPA for a list of organizations working in TCCs and got back a list with six organizations and six TCCs. But from some of our own work, we seem to think that there may be 11. Again, if that is correct, that's 11 out of 51. So it means 40 who might not be having psychosocial services at all. Again, we could be wrong, but that's a question you want to raise. When we asked who is funding these services, some of it is coming from the Department of Social Development to some organizations. Some are getting funding from the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria. Some we're getting from RTI International, but that funding stopped in September, so they are no longer being supported to work in the TCCs. So already Lifeline and Childline have indicated they are going to be withdrawing their services from the TCCs because they aren't receiving funds. And others such as GRIP and Soyanda Victim Empowerment Program are also saying they may have to leave because they are no longer being funded. So I think the point being that a service without a psychosocial support can't be claimed to be victim-centred. It's criminal justice victim-centred because you can see all the services that are in place are about serving court cases and convictions. And I think there are many who we can realise are not going to possibly end up in a conviction. There does need to be psychosocial support as well. So the question, our recommendation is that there needs to be not only a policy, but it also needs to address the question of those psychosocial services. We note that the Department of Justice's current financial structure doesn't allow us to pay for NGOs in the way that the Department of Social Development does. But there is quite a bit of hidden subsidization of the justice system coming from NGOs, and there needs to be policy that spells out who pays, who's responsible. Which I think takes us to the Sexual Offences Court. From what we can gather from a program, the ETV's breakfast show in March of this year with the Deputy Minister of Justice, he indicated that the plans are to institute within the next 5 years a total of 95 such courts. The concern, again, which relates to Tutuzela care centres, is that will serve only a tiny minority. What about the majority? Surely there needs to be a range of different models recommended where we cannot have full deluxe versions of the TCCs or the Sexual Offences Court. What is the quality of justice that others receive? So I think that's our first point. Our second point about the Sexual Offences Court is the first pilot was in 1993. In 1999, the Department of Justice gender policy document said we will be rolling these out. In 2003, the NPA and the Department of Justice came to an agreement. In 2005, the NPA seems to have developed a blueprint, but in the same year, a moratorium was declared on the rollout. So I think we're seeing some very conflicting policy movements going on here, and we're also seeing that because there is no policy, the decision can be very easily reversed. And I want to go back to the point about we made in the monitoring. We had 15 courts who said they were specialized sexual offences courts, but that will depend on what is the definition of what you use as a specialized sexual offences court. We would say only 5 of those courts properly qualify because they have dedicated prosecutors who only deal with sexual offences and have received training in that regard, a court role that is set aside, as well as magistrates. So of those 15 who said they were specialised, only 5 really qualified if you use those 3 criteria. So I think the point really is there needs to be policy so that if something's going to call itself a sexual offences court, it is measured across that. It isn't just a plaque over a door that says sexual offences court. And again, this is going to go to the question of how many prosecutors are going to be made available. Ideally, there should be 2 to every court. So that while one is prosecuting, the other is preparing, subpoenaing and doing all the other preparation for trial. So I think, again, the questions around staffing in the NPS are quite critical when we talk to the sexual offences court. Again, the Deputy Minister indicated that only 95 were going to be established due to budgetary constraints. So again, one needs to see what is the base, what is the base against which that budget has been calculated. I think just wanting to go back to civil society, there is clearly a range of services that are being provided. I talked about hidden subsidisation earlier in relation to the TCCs, but it also relates to court preparation services, where you are having organisations provide those, but they're not being funded. The same with things like mental age assessments. We have complainants who have a cognitive impairment. It's often NGOs who are providing the mental age assessments. There is no compensation being provided for that. Court reports in terms of victim impact statements, children's reports on the impact of the rape, their ability to testify, all that is being provided by NGOs, but again, is not being funded for. So again, the need for policy and policy that says who pays for this. I think the other point that then becomes of concern if we look at the strategies is that we might be providing services but we're not being included as stakeholders. So how do our views get properly reflected? How do they get taken seriously into account in the development of policy and in the provision of service? The NPA might refer to us as stakeholders, but the Department of Social Development doesn't. I mean, Justice, sorry. What I said about social development is not, but that's another story.
Just on that point, we note that the Sexual Offences Court's reintroduction strategy, civil society weren't called in. And these are being introduced. I spoke to a prosecutor last night who said we're already busy putting these in place. So it's just, you know, we have experience. We've worked alongside colleagues in the department for years. And it seems quite glaring that in spite, again, I think of rhetoric, and I feel quite strongly about this rhetoric about an inclusive, open, I think the principle of participatory democracy is mentioned somewhere in the justice strategy and so on. It needs to be seen, and it needs to be seen. In fact, the NPA plans don't even mention civil society. They talk very specifically about justice cluster as stakeholders. At no point does the NPA plan refer to a civil society stakeholder, which I think is not helpful, not helpful for survivors. On the question, we've also got some points for the committee. It's risky, but we note very specifically, in addition to the broad mandates on oversight and so on that you're very well aware of, and wanted to also say we're very pleased you called hearings. We know it's the first official time you've really done that, and we're sorry that more organizations didn't pick it up. However, we do hope that won't be a reason for you not to do it again. Hopefully, if you look at correctional services who've been doing it for a while, people become more familiar. So that's just another point I'd like to throw in. But in respect of the sexual offences processes, sorry. The Act does mention very specifically and provide very specifically a role for the committee. And I note in a previous conversation that the committee has had on this, there was some concern that perhaps it's too much of an expectation given the incredibly full agenda of justice, of all committees, but justice in particular. We do want to note that at the time, many of us were sitting in the room when that committee was developing the law. And there were such grave concerns precisely about what we're sitting with now, with the Annine Boysen's matter, bringing it to the forefront, that we can have policy in place. These issues require not just shifts in the letter of the law and in the word of the policy, but they require shifts in values which show in budgets but also show in practice. And so at that point, and I stand to be corrected, there were other people in the room, including committee members then, but there was a very strong feeling being articulated that this committee needs to, until the executive's getting it right or doing better, needs to maintain quite a high level of oversight. So I know you've got competing issues here, but would like to just really sell that point quite loudly. So the Act provides in a number of sections, and they're noted here and in the submission, for oversight on the development of the NPF after a year, which I know you're aware of, it's now 5 years. It requires oversight or review of the NPF after 5 years. Well, we're at 5 years of implementation of the Act and not yet don't yet have a national policy framework. It also requires that Parliament, doesn't say this committee, but requires that Parliament on an annual basis get reports from the various departments on what they're doing. So not just reports from Justice. So I understand that there's talk of possibly having a joint sitting with some of the other committees, and we would heartily encourage that. And then there's another provision with respect to training programs and any changes in training programs and instructions and policy directives. So really this is just a call to your conscience, your busy conscience, but particularly with, I think, what is placing pressure on the committee right now is also for us a pressure that the fourth parliament's ending really soon. And if this doesn't happen now, we're going to be sitting with a new committee. And this is also important for us, very, very important.
Tell them to speak for themselves, Jada.
On the issue of oversight, the last point is we would love the opportunity also to engage with the committee on the development of plans on the sexual offences courts. The Shukumisa campaign has discussed this quite a lot, and we're actually referring to improved prosecution of sexual offences very deliberately and not narrowly talking to the rollout of courts, and it's linked to Lisa's points about flasks on doors. But thank you very much. That's it. Yes, thank you.
All right, thank you. You've given us a lot to think about. All right, now it's time for questions and comments. Honourable members, Debbie Schaefer, Steve Swart, John Jeffrey, Kanam Ilana Majake, in that order.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's mostly just comments. Firstly, I'm glad to see that the Shukumisa campaign is adopting my model of calculating statistics, not the 60-something, 80-something percent model of the NPA. We are all very aware of the issues regarding statistics and have been taking it up for quite some time. We were told last year by the NPA that they were going to give us better statistics this year, and that part of the problem was that they hadn't been collecting data according to the new legislation. So we are sincerely hoping that this year's annual report will yield better statistics on that score. As far as the case management from SAPS reporting to correctional services, we've been promised that for the last 12 or 13 years. We've also been following that up. It's called the Integrated Case Management System, and we will continue to follow it up. The department has recently given us quite a detailed account of what delays have been. It's, as usual, a silo approach in government and no coordination whatsoever between the various organizations, departments, as well as CETA. There's just been no cooperation, particularly from SAPS, as far as I understand. As far as the lack of detail, I think it is a serious concern. It's my concern as well. I did ask the minister in Parliament what the budget allocation was going to be when he announced the reintroduction of the sexual offences court. He said we would know now when the budget came up and the DG could tell us. So we will be asking the DG tomorrow and the next day when they appear before us as well, because I had exactly the same concern. We're very grateful to see that they are going to be reintroduced. We're concerned that they were stopped in the first place, but it doesn't mean anything unless there's money allocated to it and a particular plan. I do just have a concern regarding, I think you've got a point about a policy, but a policy is not a cure-all. I mean, it's sort of implied that a policy is going to be inviolable. Policies can also be changed. So it's not, so I don't know if that's necessarily the prime cause. I think the real issue is that we need a proper plan with detail as to how, where, when, what, and how much it's going to cost and who's going to pay. I think that point is well taken, and I think we need to take that up with the department tomorrow. And yes, we would also like to engage with the implementation of the courts. We haven't been given any details about requesting them. And I certainly will be taking that up with the DG tomorrow and Wednesday, or whenever they're Thursday. I think that's all really for now. I would just like to ask them, do you have any better statistics? I mean, it doesn't sound like it from your input. Do you have better statistics as far as reported cases, convictions, and incidents in various courts or not? And if so, if we could get access to them. Thanks.
So thank you. As always, the submissions are very good, and we always appreciate the inputs. Could I just ask also on the issue of the low conviction stats? I know that you've often, and it's broadly in the media, the degree of underreporting. So if you comment on that in the view of the stats of reported cases, is it correct 1 out of 10 cases is reported? And maybe you could just comment generally. Then that puts a whole different light to the stats that we've got before us. The vast number of sexual offences cases that aren't even reported. And then secondly, of major concern is the issue of funding of NGOs and the incredibly good work that NGOs do on your page 14, and we fully acknowledge that. It is very clear that NGOs are subsidising the DOG and the MPA services in a range of hidden ways. It is essential that these services be compensated for. And I fully agree with that, particularly in view of the global financial crisis and the funding constraints that NGOs are faced with. As you pointed out, Lifeline has had to withdraw its services. We see what's happened to RAPCAN. So would you just comment on that further? Because clearly this is an issue that is ongoing, and NGOs are going to face even greater financial constraints as we are going forward. And this is something we need to address fully, particularly where, as you mentioned, the specific issues such as the mental age assessments, the children's reports, are a necessity for the completion of criminal cases. How can we as a committee allow that funding to go, for NGOs just to close down when they are providing such services? And it's something that we need to look at very carefully. Thank you very much.
Mr. Gentry. Thanks, Chair. And again, thanks for the presentation. Mine was really just on, I think that, as you know, we are intending, and I think you need to push us to have a proper evaluation of the Sexual Offences Act and its implementation, and it would be very important for you to come back for that engagement. I think this is useful in terms of we can raise some of the issues with the department and with the NPA when they come in the course of the budget process. But I just really wanted to ask on the, I've looked at the organisations forming part of Sukumisa. You're not you've got focus on particular areas where you've got a NGO that is then participating. But I'm just interested in the decision relating to the where to situate Tutuzela care centres and where to situate sexual offences courts. And a little bit worried that are they have the Tutuzela care centres been placed in the right places? And will the sexual offences courts be placed in the right places? And as you'd know, you know, your concern about the limited number of sexual courts that they won't cover everywhere, it's something we can put to the department if there's a sexual offence in an area which doesn't have a court. Would that existing court, magistrate's court, or have to deal with the matter, or could it be transferred to the nearest place? Obviously, you've then got a problem of, I suppose, witnesses would be transported, and the complainant would be transported. The accused would have to get there themselves or be brought there from jail. But it's a question of a balance of the specialization and the facilities versus the geographical problems, which would, I think, affect the community more than anything else. But do you have any sort of comments on that, the placing of Tutuzela care centers and the placing of sexual offences courts, and whether given the resource constraints, whether each court should have the capacity or whether there should be specialization where complainants and witnesses would be better treated because of training and other facilities. That's really the question. Just one question as well on the issue of your monitoring. Just a bit confused. You had 28 on your slides. You had one for KZN. Unfortunately, I would look at KZN, obviously. In your document on page 29, you've got, I think it's 31 courts that were monitored, and you've got two for KZN. And then just a bit of surprise so I don't know which one, whether you removed the one because the monitoring wasn't properly done, but just a bit of a surprise with the two courts, Amadadeni, which is Newcastle, and Msinga, and surprised that you didn't monitor any court in an urban centre, the Durban courts, because I don't know, with sexual offences, is there a geographical, an urban-rural difference? And I don't know if you've done any studies, if anybody has done any studies on that. Are sexual offences more prevalent in urban areas where there may be a breakdown of social cohesion and more other influences such as liquor and drugs which may give rise? But that would be interesting because that would also, I think, help the issue of the placing of the Tutuzela care centres and the sexual offences courts. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Just to say thank you for the presentation and just the idea of really managing to pull together this number of NGOs to work towards really looking at issues of sexual offences and abuse of women and children. But at the same time, I think one thing that is important is to just really manage to address as to how you've interacted with justice, the Department of Justice. You have all the information, but I'm just curious to know how you've been engaging the Department of Justice and what type of responses you're actually getting from them. Because this matter that you're actually raising, or the matters you're raising, are quite crucial, but also at the same time, it would be quite interesting to understand how the Department of Justice has been responding to it, because sometimes it's actually important to do such engagement so that you actually, instead of really reporting on it, you input into their own processes. And the one other thing that I think is quite impressive is just the historic level of activism on this. We have high levels of rape and murder in South Africa, and it's good to note that there are NGOs that are still really very much interested in participating in efforts of this nature. The register, of course, is something that is a little bit contentious because it's in different jurisdictions. because the Women's Ministry does the one, and then you've got the Department of Justice. And what you're actually suggesting is that they need to be coordinated, which could actually be cost-effective. But I guess it's a matter of actually jointly engaging the two departments. And similarly to what I've actually indicated earlier, it would be important to understand is whether you've already engaged the department on the both departments on this, and what type of responses you've really managed to get from them. And also just indicators to, you talk about the Tutuzelo centers, and what you think is really shortcomings of the Tutuzela centers. But also what's important is just to also indicate as to what extent you're actually giving support to this that has been established by the NPA. Thank you.
Mr. Jeffrey wants to...
Another issue I'd forgotten to raise also on the sexual offences courts. My understanding is that the reason the sexual offences courts got less and less was because of the presiding officers, the magistrates.
Mm.
And I think that's the understanding of the committee as a whole.
Yeah.
And basically it was an issue which I think got canvassed the most. I mean, we don't really have much access to magistrates. We have two members on the Magistrates Commission, but they don't seem to be able to supply us with this information. They're from opposition parties, so... but anyway, it was at the former Chief Justice Norwood's Access to Justice Conference that the issue came up. And the magistrates basically indicated, I think it was more on an individual basis, that, look, the reason they didn't like it was that they found these courts very stressful. They couldn't cope. And that was the problem. Now... Police, as far as I'm not aware, or the prosecutors have not raised that as a problem for not being able to continue to function. It's only the magistrates who've raised it. We're having some difficulties with the magistrates. I mean, they've had significant salary increases over the past few years, but they're currently on strike because the Chief Justice is getting a lot more than they are, and their percentage, even though their overall increase has improved substantially, the percentage they're getting in relation to the Chief Justice decreased as a result of a review from the Independent Commission. My worry is, I mean, that's maybe a little bit of a personal bugbear or whatever, you know, while government wants to re-establish and establish more sexual offences courts, I don't know if we're going to win with the magistrate. So I don't know if you've got any comments on that issue, because we're all blithely carrying on, but the problem, you know, it wasn't a government decision to reduce the number of sexual offences courts. It just happened because the magistrates got too traumatised. No, it wasn't a government decision. Definitely. It was the specialised police units were a government decision, but the sexual offences courts, they just got less and less because magistrates refused to sit in them. So it's commentary on that, because I'm afraid we're going to blithely carry on saying we're going to increase them and then suddenly find we have resistance from the magistrates. And I don't know if, sorry, just the last point on that, this issue of, you know, yes, sexual offences, dealing with sexual offences matters must be traumatic, but why is it that the police and the prosecutors can cope and the magistrates can't?
Well, to add to John Jeffrey's point, that very last point, are you guys suffering from similar stress? You have mechanisms. Right. We'd like to hear what those are and pass them on to the magistrates. Debbie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just want to refer you to your page 6 where you say here that 2005 the Minister of Justice called for a moratorium on the establishment of all dedicated courts. So it would appear, to, according to your information, that it was in fact a government decision. Can you just clarify that for us? And just in connection with John's point, I mean, yeah, I would like to know more about your experience of the magistrates. That is what we've been told, and would it be necessary in your view to legislate for those courts?
All right, Lizelle Adams.
To
Chairperson, continuing on the issue of the magistrate, in this presentation you've indicated that there should be at least two prosecutors per court. Are you then also saying that indirectly there should be two presiding officers per court?
No.
That was part of the...
Okay. All right.
Yes, I think the point about policy is fair. I mean, it can easily be ignored. But I think one can always put policy into, make policy subordinate legislation, as the national policy framework should be. But I don't think it ever has been gazetted, so it's never reached that stage. Because I think once you do have something that is the level of legislation, it is that much it's that much easier to hold people to account. Yes, so I think we would like to see that. And linked to that other question, the Lands Claims Court, for instance, are legislated for. So there could really be the scope to legislate for sexual offences courts. I mean, I think it's really a question of being creative. Some of the other comments I've heard from magistrates are that if you only sit in a sexual offences court, you only hear one type of case, you don't develop your skills across a range of different matters, which has implications for your promotion. So that was their other concern, in addition to the one about being burnt out. I mean, I think we as organizations are very familiar with it, and there is debriefing. It's a standard practice that you introduce that everybody who works with this gets debriefing. I mean, one can also arrange courts in such a way that it isn't all only and exclusively that magistrate here. One can rotate them, for example, and share different sorts of cases. So the problem is not insoluble. I just think it's asking them to be a little more flexible and a little more creative in how they are approaching the matter.
Sorry. So I have to just interject and say they don't seem to have similar concerns regarding specialized commercial crimes.
No.
So on that same point, the changes actually were a mixture of both processes. They first happened de facto. Magistrates stopped hearing courses, diversified the court roles, started moving to different courts, and very cleverly, as lawyers do, repeated messages over and over and over and over and over again. And that message becomes real. And then we saw this announcement that there was a moratorium. And what from the outside seems like a tension between the NPA, who were always pushing for these courts, and the department, particularly the magistrates, who were holding back. These questions about what we do to deal with it, and Lisa's answered it in terms of debriefing, but the fact is, if it's a priority, people need to implement it, and it comes down to power. This whole story is about who's holding the cards and who's able to control what happens. We say legislation is enforceable. Well, with respect, we're sitting here with sexual offences legislation that's not being implemented. So nothing is enforceable if we don't make it happen. And it's about, we see this over and over again, when there's priority given to something at a very high political level, you see changes happen. You see good managers being put in place who care about the issues, as opposed to managers who don't know anything. And that speaks both from a national and senior provincial level to down at local level. That's where the priority will be given teeth. If you have, and we have had courts where magistrates did rotate, Khayelitsha Court as a case in point, the magistrates did not only hear these matters. They did, as Lisa said, they moved around different courts, but they followed a matter, because very importantly, you don't want a different magistrate presiding over the same case. So when it comes back on the roll, the magistrate's back in that court. The bottom line must be that there are certain standards that must be adhered to before a magistrate hears any matter. So if they're hearing all kinds of matters, fine. But have they been exposed to the case law and debate on the case law? Why has the law developed in this way? It's not good enough to expect that magistrates, and again, with all due respect to magistrates, are just reading reams and reams of legislation and cases and understanding what's behind the thinking and the decisions. So whether you call it training or whether you find some other much more amenable term to use, that magistrates will actually sit in a room and develop their thinking about these issues, that must be in place. Selection criteria must be in place. But senior management of, you know, in terms of the presiding officers, needs to also hold people to account. And that, for me, at the end of the day, is where the shift will or won't happen. It's not going to help being left at a local level.
I mean, I think in terms of engaging with the Department of Justice, We have written to them to ask if we could please have some discussion with them around the sexual offences court, and the Deputy Minister did respond last week to acknowledge the letter and say that further correspondence will be forthcoming. So he seems to be a reliable person, so we are hopeful. Yes. So we have tried to engage with the department, and I think it's where one has to acknowledge, frustrating as it is, that two people cannot do all the work that is required. So there is much to criticize about the department, but the fact that there are only two people trying to do all of this must inevitably mean that things are not going to be, that they're going to take forever, and that there won't be the kind of process followed that we'd like. So we're engaging with the department. I think they could be doing much better, but we acknowledge that something must be done about the very few people allocated towards dealing with sexual offences and their seniority. I think in relation to looking at the statistics, I will send you that study I referred to from Mpumalanga. It is a case study, but I think it is quite useful because it does start to suggest either there's something particularly odd going on in that particular area, or there are some important differences between urban and rural rates in rural areas. One of the things that was quite striking was that this particular area where we did the research is part of the main gun running route from Mozambique into South Africa. So what was striking was that the number of firearms being used in rapes in this one police area was double that, the usage of guns in Gauteng. It was Ekelhoek. So and that is because I think is a consequence of the fact that it's part of that flow. And I think for the key point to that is that, as I said, that had the one conviction rate out of 120 for adult women, which was simply appalling. And I think one of the points you wanted to make to the police is that clearly there is a percentage of rape that is linked to a whole lot of other crime, like hijacking, like illegal firearms, etc. So they should be paying attention to all of those crimes because some of them are linked. And if you are dealing with illegal firearms, you may well be dealing with some rape. Because I think the other thing that was very striking about this area was that close to 60% of rapes were reported with stranger rape, which is striking. That is higher than you would see in an urban area. There are two ways to interpret that, is that the majority of women are not reporting rapes by those known to them, or that you are seeing other things going on in that area which is linked to the firearm smuggling. But what was also particularly distressing was in that three-year period we identified 13 men whose names were tied to 37 different rapes over that three-year period. Every single one of them was arrested. Not one of them ever stood trial. Not once do we see the police or the prosecution ever saying, we need to watch this man. One of those men in that three-year period had six rapes, which included housebreaking. There was another man, looking backward, who had another five rapes. So if you add all those rapes that fell out of the study period, his name was attached to 11 different rapes. So if you have 30 men who in one rural area account for 37 rapes, clearly if the police were making more effort into stranger rapes, they would be preventing a portion of rape. So I think that was deeply disturbing that in one rural police station you can see something like that. So that was an issue. I mean, again, I don't know whether this place is an anomaly because it's obviously sitting on a firearm smuggling route and does have higher levels of crime, but that was clearly something to be looked at. What was also striking about this area is that you had more children reporting rape than adults. That is counter to trends nationally and internationally. So the conclusion one can draw from it is something very strange is going on in that area. Or, again, and it links to the high percentage of stranger rapes, the majority of adult women are not reporting. And I think if only one out of 120 saw a conviction for her rape in the space of 3 years, I am quite sure that the vast majority of other women are looking at that and thinking, why waste my time? Rural areas are small, people know who you are, the stigmatization is great. So I do think in rural areas, because the bonds are much closer, people are known to each other, bad news about the criminal justice system travels more rapidly. Plus, I think the likelihood of people being known to the police and being known to the court authorities is probably greater than you would see in an urban area. So, you know, I think those are some of the issues to be looked at in relation to rural areas, and also they are clearly not quieter and calmer than urban areas, that's for sure. If you look at the levels of violence, the physical violence that is accompanying a lot of these rapes, as well as the usage of firearms. Just as another comment, and this goes to the police, is that Close to 60% of rapes in that area were witnessed by at least one other person. Somebody was in the room at the time the rape happened because there'd been a break-in, or somebody was abducted at gunpoint while they were walking. But the police took statements in 30%. You know, the quality of policing, of detective work in that area, and these were specialized detectives, was poor. It really was poor. I can't say the prosecution was exciting, but, you know, if that's the basis you start from. So I do think there are questions to be looked at in terms of quality of what's going on in urban and rural areas.
Just picking up on those points, I mean, on the last point Lisa's made, one of our recommendations is for much stronger prosecutor-led investigations, and that's the strength and through TCC. So just to note that in relation to this picture. The question of the issue of do we have better stats? We have better stats in very, as people like Lisa have undertaken research and others of our colleagues, in very narrow areas. We don't have the big picture. We are not. You can't get the information out of government. We certainly can't. And we don't have the kind of machinery behind us to get the scale of money, to get the scale of information needed. That's why we are dependent on these sorts of documents to try and help us understand what's going on. What Lisa's pulling out in one area, it's a chilling picture. I think all of us are feeling the discomfort. That is, and I really do have a question of, is this really all the information that we have? Sorry, is this really all, excuse me, get a bit excited about this. No, just, is this what we, all that, that's being recorded? I don't know, but I'm questioning the department. If this is the information we're being provided, they've been asked this question on the integrated justice system, for how long? For how long? Is it really true that it's just some problem with the communication and planning and silos? Or is it that we don't want to see this picture? The problem, it's very ugly politically. It isn't good to show this picture. At the same time, if we don't look at it, we will not fix it. So it really is going to require, I think, a great level of will and push to actually be willing to look at how ugly this society is, from general responses through to criminal justice responses, in order to change those responses. Lisa, you didn't, and I wondered if you wanted to give a response to this question of where SOCs and TCC should be placed. I wanted to just start with what our colleagues in the campaign said. When we did the submission, we had a whole bunch of telephone conferences and email processes, so not just us speaking from research, it's anecdotal information. And people did really struggle with this question of, is it just about SOCs? What about the areas that are not going to be covered by courts? How do we deal with it? And so we decided very clearly that what we want to do is call for improved prosecution, and I said that earlier. And it is in response to this issue of how resources are going to be spread around. So that we feel very strongly the gaps in services, in our services and in state services. It's why one of the points we've made is in the improving access to justice in previously disadvantaged communities. We need to see sexual offences in there. We need to see how many sexual offence courts or how many prosecutors are in those areas as well. It is a difficult question in terms of resources, but overall the feeling is there are some, we don't want to say minimum, but there are certain standards that have to be in place. And at the end of the day, we have to be driven by the fact that Lisa spoke about out of 120 cases, there's one conviction. There are 119 human beings, women in this country, who have a particular experience, and that has got to drive it. It's not just about numbers. I think that if we can have a national sex offender register, and we're not dealing with the convictions yet, but we're dealing with what we do with the few that we manage to convict, what's the point? So, sorry, yeah, I mean, some stuff on rural and urban. I don't know if you wanted to talk to that further, though.
I mean, I think at this point, and it makes good rational sense, on one level is that the NPA is saying they're citing the TCCs where they have the greatest number of rapes being reported. And that makes sense, because if you look at the level of infrastructure and personnel required, it's hard to justify having six people sit around doing nothing when you've got a casualty that's overloaded with staff. So I think that point is perfectly, is a very reasonable one. But I think the issue is the fact that there is no thought about what are the other models that you could use in peri-urban and rural areas. We've got the TCC, and that's it. there no other thoughts about what are the other minima that we could have in place? How else might we structure services so that even if the service doesn't look the same, the outcome is the same? And that's what we really want, is the same sorts of outcomes. Not necessarily all the bells and whistles, but that everyone's getting access to counselling, good investigation by the police, good medico-legal examination, and good prosecution. So I think that's a challenge to throw to the NPA, is to think beyond the TCCs. By all means, let us keep them, they're doing a good job, but we need something else. So that's the first question to ask them. I think with the Sexual Offences Court, my sense that they're probably going to be linked to where there is a TCC. So you will then have about 40 which are not linked to a TCC. But I mean, we have hundreds of courts throughout the country. Again, you can follow the logic of let's put them where the most rapes are coming through, and that's going to again be, I think, large urban centres. So what about the other smaller centres? So back to, I think, the point of either we have a minimum below which nobody must go, and we have norms and standards in place to ensure that, and anything above that is wonderful, but there's a minimum that everybody gets. Because I think, and it's something we struggle with even though we promote specialisation, is that specialisation can have the inadvertent effect, I think, of limiting service accessibility. So I think we want to strike the balance between ensuring that people who are specialised are available to everybody, and we don't create inaccessible services. But you don't have to have a structure or money, I think, to have a good service. There's sometimes this assumption that there's a lot of money that's got to be thrown into a service, yes. But compassion, knowledge about your issue, don't cost money. And I think it's ensuring that the training is happening so that the people are knowledgeable. And then I think the infrastructure one can add to that. But not all these things need to cost a fortune. It's the attitudes and the skills of the people who are coming in that I think are so important to be looking at. So again, taking your point, you can't legislate for everything. But there do need to be norms and standards in place. And maybe it's time to... The Department of Justice used to have inspectors who went out to court to look at what was going on. Maybe it's time to... And I believe they still function in the Western Cape. I've met one or two, but I'm not aware of them outside the Western Cape. Well, okay, sorry, that was not intended to be any sort of endorsement to anybody, sorry. Okay, good. There we go. So I think the... But I mean, I think there is something to be thought about reintroducing those. On the monitoring, the report that you have, as you correctly pointed out, is for 2010. The figures we gave are for 2011. That report is not available yet. So you're right, there is a discrepancy. We will send that report within the next... I do believe it's gone to print. So we will try and send that to you within the next few weeks or so that you do have the most recent data to allow for that. I think...
Yes. Just looking at the budget and the costs about providing a good quality service across all courts to sexual offences as opposed to picking 40 to 90. If you look at some of the things we need, so we need it... We're talking about articulating it clearly in policy and driving that through with strong political leadership, no extra cost. We're talking about having court roles that are not diverse, that only deal with one kind of matter, no cost associated. We're talking about CCTV systems already covered in the Mokwena Pashwane matter, where the Concord has required that these services must be available for any sexual offence relating to children. The costs have already largely been absorbed. The ongoing costs are around making sure those last courts have them and the maintenance happens. It's not a new cost because sexual offence courts are coming in. It's got to already be in place. If you look at the costs of training that will come up, it should not be crippling. Training costs, you know, in terms of the big picture budget, should not be crippling. The major cost is going to be if we maintain the standard of the two prosecutors per court. It's exactly the weakest point of the NPA strategy, where not their weak point, but them saying this is what our problem is. That is the cost we need to cover to make sure that we have this kind of service. The other thing, getting the right people in the job, selection processes and training, that's not actually huge extra money. It's will that's behind this, really. Sorry, the last point you didn't talk about was CCC and civil society funding.
I think just in relation to funding, from what I gather from conversations with the Department of Justice, their particular financial agreements and structures don't allow them to fund NGOs. I understand. But that is, I stand to be corrected, but it is something you can take up with them. So it does mean things like the organizations who sit in courts acting as clerks in relation to the Domestic Violence Act, they don't get compensated for by the Department of Justice either. That is funding that those organizations raise themselves. So that, I think, is something to look at, is what are those agreements? The one department who can pay for this is the Department of Social Development. But the Department of Social Development's funding model is very restrictive. In terms of personnel, they pay for social workers, and recently, Dave, we've managed to squeeze them to go to auxiliary social workers. A court preparation officer does not fit into that category. Some of the people who write reports may have some of their salary covered by DSD, but not necessarily for that. So you need to look at the fit between DSD policy on funding and DOJ, whether DOJ is going to need to alter their funding policy or whether DSD needs to alter and expand what they do focus on. I mean, again, one wants to look at how DSD has returned money unspent. So there again, there is money. And it's looking, we're not asking for new additional extra funds. We are looking at there is existing money, it's how it's being used and not spent, that is the concern. But at this point in time, so there's been nothing going to the TCCs. I think RTI was funding some, not all, until September. That's gone. Whether new funding is planned and hasn't yet come on stream, I don't know, but it's quite a dangerous gap. They said organizations are withdrawing services. I'm going to use the example of GRIPT, who, Greater Nelspruit Rape Intervention Project, which, from what we can see, is the only, apart from Asisi Kumeni, out in Kamathiput, is the only organization providing specialized rape services in Mpumalanga. If they don't receive funding for the end of the year, they will close down, which means the 19 services they are providing, the 19 different little offices they have throughout Mpumalanga, will disappear. So I think though they will start retrenching, I think, within the next 2 to 3 months. So I think that, I hope, will give you a sense of how dire this is, especially for organizations in rural areas who don't have a high profile, where people are not aware of their existence. So I do think it's something that does need to be looked at, and I think the NPA, none of that budget, because we asked, is going to, that increase to the Tutuzela care centers goes to services. It only goes to staff within the TCCs employed by the NPA. So that gap remains, and it does need to be addressed.
All right, there's a second round. I've recognized Prof. Ndabandaba, J.B. Sibanyoni, Bilana Majake, Schaefer, Jeffrey, and Sheila Shopestole. That's it.
Thank you, Chair. We are very grateful for this presentation, but talking about criminal statistics, there's what we call in criminology the dark figure of crime. Now, I think the biggest problem we have when we talk about sexual offenses, that most of them are in the dark figure. They're not reported for many reasons. One reason, for example, is fear of further victimization. Another reason is in the family. Maybe the girl is afraid to report the crime, the father or the uncle did something. So I wonder if you could do some research there. Because we won't get a complete picture of sexual offenses if we still covered by the dark figure of criminal statistics.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the information that you are giving us. You know, the statistics that you have, I think my proposal is that we request that you share it with the particular member of parliament in that area. For example, when you spoke about Akonhoek, the lady sitting next to me is from Akonhoek. Yes. And then we do oversight and monitoring. When we visit police stations, usually they tell us about their success story. So some of the underlying things, like the figures you have access to, sometimes we don't pick them up. You see, in my own area, in a place called Ekangala in Bronkhorstspruit, people were saying, you've got a person who's arrested for rape, for example, but who will also be a suspect in another case but still get bail.
And then we keep on looking for that. Who is that person? I think we don't have sufficient capacity to try and link that person, that this person has had a rape case before, and then is the second one. And also the question of withdrawal of cases and the like. I remember I personally asked the Minister of Justice to say the NPA, do they have a way of monitoring the withdrawal of cases? And I did get a response from the minister. But I think as the civil rights, you may have information that you can feed to the MP. Say, MP, this is what we've got from your constituency. And then armed with that information, I think we can be empowered. Thank you. In fact, I only got to know about your gender health and justice research, the GHRU at the JSC, when you were compiling reports on each and particular candidate was appearing before us. Yes, this is familiar. I didn't know the individuals, I only know the documents. Thank you very much.
Filani Majake.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make a further comment on infrastructure and personnel distribution. I'm just very much worried about what you are alluding to in terms of just two staff members in some directorate who are responsible for sexual offences. But indeed, I think probably also for us to actually get much more valid information is just the engagement that I've actually asked about with the Department of Justice. And I'm happy that you've actually contacted the minister. But it could have been nicer by the time you come here that we have the responses of the minister, so that by the time the Justice Department comes to report to us, we have that kind of response that we can actually make them account for. You've indicated that the Department of Justice doesn't actually fund NGOs, which I think is a competency of social development mostly, but the Department of Justice, when they come and report to us, they talk about advice officers that they are funding. And I think that's a component of NGOs that the Department of Justice is actually funding, which you actually need to look at. Because also in terms of the areas that you think Judicial Centers are not covering, I would actually say that if you work with advice officers, you may actually be in the position to introduce some of the services. Like I indicated earlier, the work that the NGOs are doing, the work that you're doing is very good for monitoring and being the watchdog to government, but also at the same time supporting. And maybe if you actually try to look at that dimension, it might to a large extent exist. What I'm actually also curious on is, to what extent are you working with Chapter 9 institutions? Because what you're doing also is the responsibility of Chapter 9 institutions.
Yeah.
That are supposed to monitor access to justice so that you can even use their mandate to make the government departments to account as partners and stakeholders within the work of the Chapter 9 institutions. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Just 2 points. I just want to know your views. I mean, my view, and I believe the previous Chief Justice at the Access to Justice Conference also said that in his view that judicial officers should be able to deal with any kind of matter that comes before them. Do you agree with the statement that the specialization is more important for the police units and the prosecution than for the magistrates? So as long as the prosecutors are specialized, the magistrates should all be able to deal with sexual offense and should all be trained to deal specifically with victims of sexual offense. But if that is the case, would that be, in your view, okay? Or do you think there should only be specific magistrates assigned to those courts permanently or semi-permanently or for a certain period of time? And then also, if you will comment on this, I mean, my experience over the last weekend was quite shocking in that you assume that all things that don't go wrong, you know, happen with the police investigation and that the police investigations aren't right. Where I had completely the opposite experience over the last weekend, where the police did completely everything correct. They got some guy before the court. They didn't get the guy before the court. The prosecutor said at 10:03 in the afternoon, it was too late to put the case on the roll when they got the fingerprint match, and let the person go.
Yes.
3 weeks later, he attacked another couple and slashed their faces. Now, how often do you find prosecutors not doing their job? not bringing people for bail hearings and courts. The other issue is, it appears to me, the prosecutors and the magistrates do not take into account the requirements in the Criminal Procedure Act for granting of bail, particularly people who have previous convictions, mm-hmm. or people who are out on pending other cases. Can you comment on that? Do you have any experience in that and or statistics or case studies?
Jeffrey? Building on that last point, it would be useful through your constituent organizations if there was some kind of reporting individuals who are not doing what they should be doing. So whether they be members of the police, whether they be prosecutors, whether they be judicial officers. And I don't know if, I think there's no hotline, but it's something as far as the prosecutors and the magistrates, Chair, that we could raise with the NPA and with the department, that there should be a mechanism. I suppose the police have got the IPID, but that there should be a mechanism, and it would be useful if you can encourage your constituent organizations to give reports where there are problems and good reports where officials have behaved well. Personally, my worry, I'd be interested in your comment from Debbie Schaefer on should all magistrates be able to handle these? I think the fact is that they can't. And no matter what screening you do, that you will have some who just do not have the empathy needed, because you may not need that empathy in terms of other criminal cases or civil cases. The one thing I wanted to raise is the other aspect model that could be looked at would be a sort of circuit sexual offences courts to travel to the rural areas like a high court does in some areas. I don't know if that would require a legislative, because it's a court going into a different jurisdiction, whether that would require legislation. But it's something I think that I hope you and your organizations will canvas these issues more. Then on the issue of money, my understanding is those advice centers, that was donor money from the European Union, and so that was sort of a bit different. The last point I just wanted to make was the NPA have this category called informal mediation. And you will see on their statistics a growing number of cases which get dealt with by way of withdrawal, and it's dealt with by way of informal mediation. It's not regularized as far as statute. So plea bargaining, which can be quite controversial, is regularized as far as amendments to the relevant legislation. Informal mediation isn't. I do get worried that it's a lazy prosecutor who maybe the 3 o'clock one who, and cases get withdrawn and gets put down to informal mediation. So question one is, do you have any sort of comments? Have you been monitoring informal mediation as far as sexual offences matters? Point two would be, in sexual offences, what's the term you give to it? Not stranger, the opposite, where the, acquaintance, but basically where the victim and the accused are known or maybe even intimately connected in the same family, an incest or a partner or something. Is there not some kind of space where you have, and those are the cases that you have these high withdrawals, because the victim is dependent on the perpetrator, and if she continues or she's under pressure from her family, to drop the case because he's looking after you, maybe he's also looking after other members of her family. Other possibilities of the prosecution agree to withdraw the case if the accused goes on some training program. So the issue of deferred prosecutions and things like that. I suppose one needs to be careful that it doesn't get abused, particularly by people in the justice system who maybe have a negative, have a prejudicial view of sexual offences and the relations between men and women.
But, I mean, have you thought about that? Because that also may be something that would require amendments, that it may be better in a particular case where the victim is reluctant to continue because the perpetrator is somebody that she's intimately connected with, and, you know, that maybe sending the person on a program may help. Yeah. Anyway, just that is for comment. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I'm sorry, I didn't hear your input. I had to go to another committee and I had to come back. But I hope you stay in Cape Town. And yeah, because I would really like to sit down with you. And you see all the areas you've been talking about, Komati Port is my area. I come from Mpumalanga, but in particular, Akonhoek. And you see, as a layperson, I have observed this, but I couldn't lay a hand on this type of information. And you see, you must be very grateful that we have got a new democracy and we've got ministers who are activists. And if you give me proper briefing, I think I need to talk to the minister directly. I work with him on other issues. Thank you.
Thanks. This is a tour. I think Lisa will probably have a lot more to say on the dark figure of crime and the issue, sorry, it was raised earlier as well, of the underreported cases. The reality is, and I'm quite aware that this committee knows it, that justice and NPA cannot deal with that dark figure on its own. Doing the work of the department well will certainly help in the instances, as was mentioned, where people choose not to report on the basis of their fear of secondary victimization or the fact that they see that there's this not just bad response but at times quite harmful response by the criminal justice system. So improving the operations with the cases that are currently reported is a very good starting point, in my opinion, for the department. There is an enormous amount of work to do, and many of the organizations in the Shukumisa campaign and many this department as well as other, not this department, the Justice Department as well as many others are concerned, or at least speaking to what needs to be done more broadly. But I think right now what we do know is that it's significantly high. There's various numbers and research as to whether it's 1 in 10, 1 in 6, 1 in 20. You know, we can look at each research and take the reasoning on its merits, but the fact remains is that it is incredibly dark and there's a huge hole. And what this committee can do is talk to the cases that are currently in the system and start addressing those cases better so that if we can affect that dark figure through that route. And if you want to say anything else on the stats, the dark.
I mean, with the sort of research that has been done, one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons that is given for not reporting is a lack of faith in the criminal justice system, that the matter will go nowhere. So I do think if one makes the criminal justice system look more appealing and more effective and be more appealing and more effective, that it will help reduce that dark figure. But that in of itself is not going to do it by itself. But yes, it is a concern, and I think a more effective justice system could contribute to reducing it.
Then on the question of our work with Chapter 9, it's a large group of organizations who work together and separately with various institutions. So yes, we do work with Chapter 9. I'm not sure how much I should go into, but as we know, the Commission on Gender Equality is increasing its capacity, and I've certainly personally, I'm not speaking on a research base,
okay,
slightly more responsiveness from some of the commissioners, but isolated commissioners over the past 2 years. I'm not yet, and this is not research, it's really just my opinion, I'm not yet convinced that the shifts are embedded in the institution, the shifts that are required. But I am seeing a will from some of the commissioners that I'm finding heartening, asking the difficult questions. In terms of the Human Rights Commission, in different ways that the various officers are helping, but I think an enormous amount more can be done in terms of their monitoring function, and I think we will hear in response to that the resource in question. So, but yes, we do work with the Chapter 9s, with individuals and commissioners at times, whether they're doing everything they can do. And my immediate response was, honestly, if a Chapter 9 institution complains to the department about something, will it make a difference? And I think that there's some research that can be done as to the recommendations from the Human Rights Commission, for example, to different departments and the extent to which they are actioned. But I don't have all that information in front of me, but I can certainly seek it. I'm aware of it being out there to some extent. In terms of the question of magistrate specialization and whether it's required, what I was certainly saying wasn't that any magistrate can deal with these, and I appreciate very much the comments that have come to the effect that you actually require a certain, there has to be a certain personality type, you have to have a certain capacity. And I think that if one sets basic thresholds, that this has to be in place before you as a prosecutor or a court preparation officer or a magistrate can work on these matters. And there's certain things around, as I said, around aptitude and capacity, training and skilling. Then you can start to say, magistrates who already have shown this competence may choose to work on other matters as well. I personally prefer very much full-on specialization. You only deal with these cases. I think that's best. It leads to the least chinks in the armor. And I think our even having this conversation links to the point I was making about the politics of it and the power that lies in the hands of magistrates. The answer should quite simply be no. We are, as a government, choosing specialization because we need a better response. Therefore, you will do it. That's my view. I don't know if you want to say anything on that issue.
I think on the question of bail, again, referring to those two studies I spoke of, in Gauteng, about 30% of cases were being awarded bail. What was striking was in Eekhoornhoek, 80%. Were being awarded bail, which is very high considering rape is a Schedule 5 and Schedule 6. And again, this is my suspicion, and I think you may just see it in other rural areas as well, is that the nearest prison, Nelspruit, is at least 2 hours' drive away. So there are only the police cells. So my sense is that perhaps bail is being granted more often in rural areas because where do you hold all your suspects? You've only got two or three police cells. You've got a whole range of other crimes going on, and your nearest police and your nearest prison is a good 2-3 hours away. So I think there's a practical problem around granting of bail in rural areas that is clearly affecting these very high releases. I mean, the one thing that was pleasing was how few men actually did skip bail. Whether withdrawals were happening because they were intimidating the victims, I don't know, but the vast majority did actually come back. They didn't skip bail. So that was at least heartening to see. In relation to informal mediation, that does need to be watched. The Department of Justice's report for 2010-2011 gives figures for who is doing, they were calling it alternative dispute resolution. And again, we go back to the question of statistics, but it looked like from that particular table, about 40% of ADR is being performed at one court in Mpumalanga, which sounded a little odd. So there do need to be, I think, guidelines around when it's used, under what circumstances. There may well be scope for it because there are, even in the best resourced, most functional criminal justice system in the world, the conviction rate for rape is low. And that is because there are some cases which are he said, she said, they will never pass beyond reasonable doubt. But surely there must be a better means of providing some sort of justice to those groups, whether it is through very carefully designated, carefully selected, strict criteria around restorative justice alternatives, I don't know, in relation to sexual offences, but I think there might be the scope under certain circumstances where it is wanted by the victim, not where she's been told, go and ask for this. So there could be some scope for it, but I think it needs a lot of policy work and care to be a useful and thoughtful and just intervention.
And I would say that, firstly, we need to increase the chances that you're going to come across a prosecutor who actually knows what they're doing and does care, because the cautions that that Honourable Jeffries has raised are absolutely the cautions that we need to take care of. So I think the first step is to look at getting the levels of the quality of service, whether you call it specialisation or just appropriate quality, in place before we start spreading the notion of using ADR in sexual offence matters broadly. But I do agree that it's a direction in which we'll probably need to go with a lot of debate and caution. I wanted to pick up on the question, or the I think it was more than a comment to civil society around using complaints mechanisms. I'm very interested, as Honourable Jeffries asked that question, as to why our complaints, the rate of complaints coming from us as a campaign, as not organisations outside of the campaign, are getting, in my view, less over the years. And I think it has got to do with our capacity. I think also the fact that civil society organisations are more and more frequently offering services within courts. Therefore, you cannot aggravate your more powerful seniors, as in the prosecutors and magistrates in that court. It's certainly my experience, and with respect to colleagues, but my experience when I was in an NGO working on court preparation for children, RAPCAN, we first offered the service as an independent, and then our service was quite fantastically integrated into the department, but that had an impact on our critique. And it has very day-to-day impacts in terms of if, and I know prosecutors experience this in courts with magistrates, if you aggravate somebody who is senior to you on your daily, in your daily life, they can make your work in all the matters you deal with very difficult. So it can have a very negative influence for many, many victims. But point taken, I think the mechanism for complaints would be fantastic, a clear mechanism, but certainly the call to us if we just make complaints more often, a lot of mechanisms start to appear. Thank you.
Sorry, just on that. I mean, look, there can be anonymous complaints,
yeah.
Particularly where there's an outside fact to back up what happened. Obviously, where you need a complainant, it becomes more difficult. I mean, I hear the point you're making about it, and I can understand it. If it's a member of the public that's affected, they can be encouraged to make a complaint. But I think you also should use, I mean, when it comes to magistrates and prosecutors, make use of the portfolio committee, and you can
yes.
Say that something is you want this to be anonymous or not. I mean, we have, all of us, I'm sure, public servants raising issues which technically they shouldn't be with their MPs. They should be going through the hierarchy, but they do, and one can then take it up. But I would encourage that be looked at. And I think also the point from you've had an interest from some members of the committee to get know more about the problems in their constituency. So I think make use of this committee and other committees in Parliament, particularly the police one. And then, Chair, through you, can we get copies of these two articles? I don't see a web address, so it may be just easier if you can just email it.
Yeah, the two articles, if we may, not right now. You can email them to us or get them to us in another way. But also your slide presentation. I had asked Mr. Romano to just chat with you afterwards, but I may as well mention that as well. We found of late that there are people who they may not be here, but get to hear that you've made given us this briefing, and then say. Send me all the stuff they came with. And it's more and more university students, academics, and so on. And so it's good if we have that and we can do that without now chasing after you and say, listen, so and so wants that presentation. It's a bit clumsy. Is there any more honorable members?
I see that we're now getting the strategic plan of the NPA and the performance plan of the department. I think your document does refer to the NPA strategic plan. I don't know if you've seen the department's one before. I didn't see any footnotes linked to it. But I think, Chair, through you, if they have specific questions, we're having the NPA next week, we're having the department this week. If there's other questions they think we should ask, can they forward them to you or to a member or whatever?
Right.
And that would, I think, I it's only, we've got a large number of people observing. I think that would apply to them as well. I presume many of them are constituent
yes.
members,
yes, they
but they should also, yeah, feel free.
We did actually, we do have the DOJ strat plan, and I think in the quick read you missed the footnotes. But go back.
Okay, why does civil society get the strat plans before Parliament?
Well, I think
we get it from Parliament. We just know where to get them. He doesn't display his ignorance. They were available in Parliament weeks ago.
Yes, but why could they not be distributed to the committee?
It's not civil society's fault. Jeffrey's not pointing at you. He's pointing at me and Mr. Romano and the committee staff. All right. Yes, let me thank you, both of you, and everyone else who's here representing the 29 organization. We're aware that you've come some of you a long way, perhaps, and we're grateful that you could be here. You're welcome to attend the rest of our briefings. Tomorrow we'll have the Department of Justice itself. You caught us by surprise, I must admit, but it's to your credit. And so if you feel that you want to listen in, you're most welcome to attend. It's a bit difficult now. We're trying to engage with the presiding officers. The committee rooms don't have cameras anymore. So I think there's only two or three committee rooms that are transmitted via television. So that makes it difficult. I don't know whether it's a resource thing. I suspect it's something else. But we're most grateful to you for today's presentation. I think from the questions and comments, you can hear that your views are shared and we empathize with most of them, if not all. Right. Thank you. Yes.
Hello.